Good morning, Sister Josephina.
Good morning, Sister Anne. How are you today?
I'm well, and you?
I'm quite well, thank God.
Very good. Well, as I replayed your recording of yesterday, I realized that you and I omitted many of your interesting educational experiences as an author, a teacher, and a professor. You have been a consultant for various publishing companies, have lectured and taught courses at other colleges besides Boston College. You have been an officer in the National Catholic Educational Association. In effect, you have been much in demand as a speaker and advisor to both educators and to parents.
Thank you, Sister. That sounded very interesting. I would like to just mention quickly that I have been in only four of our missions in my 62 years in religious life, namely Gate of Heaven, South Boston, St. Joseph's, Amesbury, St. Joseph's in Medford, and Sacred Heart in Lynn. I have been here at the Mother House since 1944, most of all while I was teaching at Boston College and commuted there every day.
And also, you were living here when you were in the capacity of supervisor.
Correct, Sister. That's what brought me here in the original, in 1944. I was in supervision for 7 or 8 years, totally supervision, until I began teaching at Boston College, and then I was combining the two. That is, teaching at Boston College and doing my supervisory work, both of which I enjoyed. But then I felt that one of them was giving, that I was not giving full time to both, and I curtailed the supervision with the permission of Reverend Mother. I'd like to say just a word about the supervisory work. We had a very excellent program of supervision in our community. There was a primary supervisor for many years, Sister Dennard. Then there was the middle grade supervisor, who was myself, a junior high, who was Sister Clarice. These people I am enumerating were in supervision for a number of years. And then Sister Benedict, who had control of the high schools. We four worked together in many, many ways and traveled together. In those days, we could not travel alone. We had to travel with a companion. Seldom did we stay overnight. We would return here to the Mother House at the end of our day's work.
You had to do a lot of planning so that each one of you would get the maximum time in your supervision at various schools.
Usually that was done on the weekend. We would plan the week's work, where we were going to go, what we were going to do, and therefore make maximum use of the time that was allotted to us.
I know too, Sister, that you have been a consultant for various publishing companies.
Many, many publishing companies, and I'm not going into them in detail, but at least 8 to 10 of them called on me to be a consultant in various ways, along with the work in my writing that I did for the mental arithmetic books and for the spellers. I was also co-author in many other ways, minor and major, for many companies.
I'm sure just your name added to the editors and other consultants helped to make the books popular.
In a way, yes, Sister, but then you have to realize that the Sisters of St. Joseph of Boston at the time had control of over 100 schools, and therefore with my name on a book, this immediately would give the entree of the books into that particular school because Sister Josephina's name was on the book as such.
That's very true.
Not only in the writing and editing and evaluating of written materials, but I did a great deal of lecturing all over the country in Hawaii. Therefore, I was constantly on the go. There was a period of time, 8 to 10 years, when almost every evening I would be out in some local school speaking to gatherings of parents, etc., who are having a monthly meeting or a yearly meeting, and my talk was usually the same on the child and how to understand him better, how to make maximum use of the time that was allotted to parents. And I felt that I did create goodwill there and gave to the parents knowledge they probably did not think about prior to that time.
Very good. And you also lectured at various colleges other than Boston College.
There were many, many colleges. I recall teaching down at Catholic University one summer, much to the chagrin and the disappointment of Boston College, who was afraid that I was going to sign on with the Catholic University, who in fact did ask me, but I turned them down because at the time I was teaching at Boston College. St. Mary's in Omaha, St. Joseph's in Buffalo, many of the colleges around here, I came in as a special lecturer at various times. Being full-time professor, one had to be careful because I was assigned to Boston College, and this was not allowable, that is, to spread out and go into other colleges as such.
At this time, too, you were elected an officer in the National Catholic Educational Association?
Yes. As part of my work, I attended their yearly meetings. By the way, one is going on this week down in the southern part of our country. I attended their meetings. I was in as a consultant and as a, well, not exactly as president, but assistant president in many capacities during the years that I was a member of the NCEA. I was also a member of other societies too, which kept me abreast of the happenings and the new trends and the ways in which I could contribute to the particular group that I would be working with at the time.
I was about to ask you that, what benefit accrued from the fact that you were an officer in the National Catholic Educational Association?
The only benefit as such would be that your name was on the program. I would have to pay my own transportation to the meeting, whether it was in California or in the South or wherever it happened to be. They contributed nothing in any way to transportation. I must say that Boston College was very good. If I were asked to give a talk in various places outside the state, Boston College was very good about contributing to my expense, that is, the airfare expense and any other expense that would be involved with my going to the particular place as such.
Do you think that Boston College felt, and I'm sure they did, that your very presence representing their college made Boston College better known throughout the country?
Oh, absolutely. People would come up and ask about the programs and how they would become involved in it. At the time, in the early 50s, Boston College did not have a doctoral program as such. That began in the mid-50s, so therefore it was a very, very busy time for Boston College. As I mentioned, I think previously, I was one of the first to receive my doctorate from BC when it began a doctoral program. Years and years and years ago, there was a doctoral program, but that had faded out. And it wasn't until the mid-50s, as I have just mentioned, that the doctoral program was reinstituted and began to take students for the program. My work at BC at this time with the institution of the doctoral program as such was very busy because in the master's program one had to do a thesis, and then of course in the doctoral program you had to do a dissertation. Then after a few years, because of the number of master students that were in the program, the thesis for the master's was taken out and courses were instituted instead, because faculty just could not keep up with the number of doctoral people and master's students as such. I would have as many as 50 or 60 doctoral students under my jurisdiction. Seeing them constantly, advising them, helping them, reading their materials, etc., until the final came up for their final evaluation, that is their examination for their doctoral program as such. It was a very rewarding experience and one that I enjoyed thoroughly.
You were going, yesterday when we were finishing with our interview, you were about to describe for us your experiences, I hope the positive ones, and I suppose there were some negative ones, in your pursuing the doctoral program.
The positive ones was a lure, as it were, toward learning new things. It was most enjoyable. I enjoyed studying, even though I was at this time giving my full quota of time to my work as a professor at Boston College, and then doing the doctoral courses in connection with that. In no way was my teaching cut down or limited because of my studying. The negative would be that I was working with people that I rubbed elbows with every day in the week, and therefore the knowledge of new people or new professors was not mine, because I knew these people very, very well. Whether or not my presence in the classroom had any effect on them, I presume that it did, but it was never made known to me in any way. I had some very, very fine teachers at BC in my doctoral program, one of whom died a short time ago, Dr. John Walsh, who was an excellent teacher. I admired him very much.
Were there many Jesuit professors in the PhD?
Yes, there were Jesuit professors, but mostly in the theology and in the religion aspect, but those two were not my field. But I had access to them if I wanted them for anything.
Very good. And you finished at Boston College how many years ago?
In the late 1950s. I'm going to take a sweet guess and say 1956 or 57. My doctoral work was completed, and therefore I could sit back for a while and just relish the time that was mine without having to get at the books, as it were. However, as I have mentioned previously, the old saying, publish or perish, was very, very much in evidence at Boston College. And if one wanted to rise in the ranks, as it were, one had to publish. I have published over 150 articles in professional journals, and this was a constant ongoing. Right now I have two articles in preparation. They have to be redone, and as it were. First of all, you get the idea, you do your reading, your research, write it up, and then rewrite it, and then finally in the typed and final form, and then it is submitted to some professional journal who will accept it or refuse it, depending upon the topic that you have chosen and whether or not they have a surplus of topics such as that.
Now, you're doing writing these articles without any pressure. No one is forcing. You're just enjoying being a perpetual scholar.
I have to confess and say I could do better. By that I mean I could stay at it for a longer time, but where my time is my own, I am somewhat relishing this time. And when I feel like doing it, that I do. If I don't, I turn to something else.
You deserve to have that kind of leisure, Sister Josephina. Well, what was the topic of your dissertation, and was that published?
The topic of my dissertation was on the gifted child. As I mentioned previously, in my supervision, I was always interested in that child that was at the top of the list, as it were. The teacher would have on her desk a list of the IQs, and I would pick that up while I was observing that teacher, look at the top four or five IQs, spot those children from the seating plan, and observe them. In discussing with the teachers about these bright children whose IQs were 120, 125, 130, frequently the teacher would say to me, oh, they're good, but they really don't work as hard as they might. This troubled me very, very much, wondering why they don't work as hard as they might. The conferences that I gave to our teachers frequently were on the gifted. By that I mean trying to involve the teachers in working with these bright children so that the maximum amount of work would come from them. Teachers, in the main, are more interested in the child at the opposite end of the curve, that is, the slow child, because very evident, it is very evident that these children are not measuring up. Frequently, they are measuring up as much as they can, but not as much as that teacher would like. It is the child that's on the opposite end with that high IQ who's doing mediocre work, average work, and so often the teacher is satisfied with this kind of work. Talking with the teacher, giving her ideas as to how to work with these children, was a very rewarding experience for me. When I came to do my dissertation, there were a number of topics that I could choose from, and I chose an experimental study in which I compared 500 children. 250 had IQs of 130 and above, and 250 were average. By average, I mean 90 to 110 IQ. The other 250 were 110 IQ and above. I was fortunate at the time that I had access to these data from our schools, because each child in the schools taught by the Sisters of St. Joseph had an IQ test, the same IQ test given to all children, so that my data would be comparable. These children I studied in two areas, vocabulary development and reading skills. I found out that the main purpose in my study was to see whether or not the gifted, that is, that high IQ child, was doing as well as the average child was doing. And unfortunately, I found out that the average child, in so many instances, did better than the gifted. It was a statistical study in which comparisons were made between the two groups, that is, the high IQ versus the average IQ. And in the main, it was disappointing to me that the gifted child did fairly well, but not as well as would be expected with the ability that he had. Whether this was the gifted child's fault or not remained to be seen. The further study would have to be done to determine why this discrepancy appeared.
As you've been speaking, Sister Josephina, I'm looking for a defense of the classroom teacher. In the era of which you're speaking, was it not so that those teachers had as many as 50 and 55 students in the self-contained classroom? Would that have an effect?
Yes, I think it would, Sister, in that 50-55, that happened, but not in many, many of our schools. They were up in the 30s. I know the Reverend Mother in charge of education in our community would say to us as supervisors, do not let the classrooms become crowded with children. The teacher cannot take care of them. As I mentioned previously, the teachers concerned appeared to be mainly with that child on the low end of the curve. That child would receive the special kinds of assignments, get the attention from the teacher. Whether or not the teacher realized that with the slow child, there is only so much that that child can learn, and then he reaches his maximum, beyond which it's impossible to go. Whereas with the bright child, the gifted child as such, the limits are limitless, excuse the term being used twice. They are limitless in terms of what the gifted child is capable of doing. And realizing when we say gifted, no two children are alike, and even with identical IQs, one child can be very, very high in mathematics. Most children with high IQs are high in the verbal area. Therefore, they're good readers. Whether or not they are good in grammar, that remains to be seen. Grammar, spelling, dictation, etc., have to be taught to children. They do not come to them automatically. But for the most part, there is a love for reading there. And this of course, is most rewarding to a teacher when she has a group of four or five very bright children who are good readers and who want to forge ahead.
Very good. When did you leave Boston College?
there is such a thing as reaching the maximum age. It had been circulated around that when one reached a certain age, Boston College would tell you to exit. I did not wait until I reached that maximum age, but about 2 years before, I had an appointment with the dean, and I said to him, "Is this a strict edict? Must one leave when one reaches age?" I forget the age at that time. I think it was 65. And he looked at me, Father Charles Donovan, with very steely eyes and said, "Yes, you leave." That's all I needed to know. So I immediately then began to send my resumes out to different places. And I was accepted by at least 10 colleges in the area and outside the area to come in as a professor. I chose Worcester State College because of its nearness to where I lived. Worcester State College is like any other state college in that it majors in teacher education, and of course this was my field. I lived in Worcester at the time for 7 or 8 years, taught each day, and came home here to Brighton on weekends. I enjoyed my work there very much. The state law for teaching is age 70, so when I reached 70, I automatically had to retire, and that was the end of my teaching as such.
You realized then, even before you left Boston College, that you did have many more years, and you did want to continue to give and to share the knowledge that you had gained through your years of study and experience.
Yeah, I have to accept that. And knowing the people that I was teaching with, and I don't mean this in any critical way, that many of them, younger than I felt that I was yards ahead of them in my teaching expertise. However, if Father Donovan said a certain age would, then I did not wait for that age to come.
I agree. I know from having spoken to people who've had you in class that they will all say that was the class where they really learned how to teach and what to do and gain the most from it. And of course you could you realize that yourself. I think we all know whether we are good at our work or not, and you had the joy and satisfaction of knowing you were giving as much as you certainly could. You worked at, can you tell us something of your work at Worcester State? How did it differ from Boston College, and what about your students there?
Once I knew that I was not going to return to Boston College, I immediately, as I have mentioned, sent out my resumes, was accepted by many, many institutions.
Do you want to name any of them?
Yes, Fitchburg State, Boston State, Worcester State, among the state colleges, and there were other of the private colleges as well.
I imagine you perhaps had students who had become professors in those various institutions.
Correct.
So they knew what they were looking for.
Yeah. I accepted Worcester for many reasons. Number one, it was within a 30-minute ride from Brighton to Worcester. It was an up-and-coming young college, as it were. I spent a few days up there studying the area, looking over the kinds of courses that were being given, and was very much impressed. Fitchburg was a second run, and as was Boston State, but there were many older teachers there that had been there for years and years, and that kind of dissuaded me. At Worcester State, I became a full professor. Not when I first went there, but within a month, automatically, the president put me on the full professor list.
Is that an unusual occurrence?
Oh, yes, very much so. I was full professor, of course, at Boston College. But when I came to Worcester, I came in as the top level before one reaches the full professor. It means an increment in your salary and also the status that you receive from that level of instruction. I had a full-time program at Worcester State, both in the master's program and in the undergraduate. The undergraduate students, many of them were from the Worcester area naturally, and I was very much impressed when I would find out from them that a great number of them had never been to Boston, had never traveled outside Worcester. I recall one student coming into my office, and I said to him, this is a teaching experience that has just come into me. Would you like it? And he looked at the name. It was the next town, Uxbridge or Southbridge, one of the towns next to Worcester. And he shook his head and said, no. And I said, why, what's the matter? He said, it's too far. I said, what do you mean too far? It's only the next town. It isn't 15 minutes. He said, no, I want to teach in Worcester. So I immediately changed my tack then.
You found those students, I presume then, a bit more parochial, provincial type of student, differing from the Boston College student.
Very much. While at Worcester State, I lived in the dormitory, which was a big experience. The dormitory had just been erected, and I was given an apartment there, which I enjoyed very much. I was within walking distance to the classroom down over the hill. One day, I remember so well, there was a student outside the door, and he said, hi, sister, would you like a ride? And I said, a ride in what? And he said, my bicycle's right here. Oh, I said, no, I've never had a ride on a bicycle. And he said, come on, sit on, I'll take you down to the class.
And don't tell me you did.
Yes, I did.
Good for you.
And sat on the back of the bike, and he took me down to the classroom as such.
So you did enjoy your, is it 8 years, you tell me, that you taught
it? Oh, it's all that, yeah.
At State?
When I was leaving Worcester, they had a huge farewell party for me. There must have been between 300 and 400 people there. Of course, mostly students and faculty and members of my community. It was very, very lovely, and I appreciated the thought and the time and whatnot that went into it, given to me by the students.
I'm glad you brought that to mind. I know you received many awards. Can you name some of them and tell us?
What do you mean by awards now?
Well, you were honored with various...
Various time kinds of things.
Yes.
I got the Teacher of the Year 3 or 4 times from Boston College and from Worcester. At Boston College, each year, there is an award given to 4 or 5 alumni, and I was the first one to receive that maybe 4 or 5 years ago, called the William McHenry, maybe I have the name wrong, award. And that was a very, very lovely, your name is chosen out of the blue, as it were, and you're told to come at a certain time, and there's a huge number of people there, mostly faculty and friends and students whom you have had. That was the surprise. I enjoyed that very, very much. There were other awards at Boston College as well. At Worcester State, again, I got the Teacher of the Year Award 2 or 3 years before I left Worcester State. That was very rewarding. That happened at graduation. And these things come to you, you don't expect them, but they make you feel good, and knowing that your work is being appreciated and that you are of tremendous help to others. What I feel is most rewarding is even today when I am not teaching, one of our sisters will say to me, do you remember, and I'm just making up this name, do you remember John McNamara, whom you had in class? And I usually say, well, maybe I do, maybe I don't. What about him? She'll say, well, you had him back in, and then give me the year. He said you were the best teacher he ever had. He learned more from you than he learned from anyone else. That makes me feel, even today, at age 82, that I still had a little give in me that did something to students and made them feel that what they were doing, they could say, well, Josephina taught me this, or Josephina showed me how to do this with students.
Very good. And after your retirement from Worcester State, I know you have not retired, so would you just bring us up to date? You are still publishing?
I am still publishing and hope to continue to publish with God's help.
Do you do any lecturing?
Right now, within the last half a year, I have done no lecturing as such. Maybe they know that I'm getting up in that age bracket. However, if I were asked to lecture anywhere, I'm sure that I would be capable of it and would be very happy to do it. So I just will wait until that time comes. As such, I am frequently called on by various sisters who will come to me with problems that they are having in the classroom, say, "Sister, I have a boy who," and then they'll enumerate what the problem is, and I will try to help them. So in that way, I feel that I am contributing, even though I am not teaching as such.
Very good. Thank you very much, Sister Josephina. Before we finish, is there anything that you are saying to yourself, "Oh, I forgot to tell this," or "I forgot to mention that"?
At the very beginning, when you asked me where I had come from and whatnot, I lived in Charlestown, St. Catherine's School, where I graduated from, Charlestown High School. And I don't think I paid enough tribute to my good parents. When I told my mother that I wanted to become a Sister of St. Joseph, she started to cry. And her reply to me was, "Oh, but you haven't seen the world yet." I was only 19 at the time. True, I had not seen the world. I had just given up a job at the State House to enter the Sisters of St. Joseph. I had worked for a short time in order to earn the money that I needed to buy the things to enter with. My father was a working man at the Navy Yard for the government. There were four others, all younger than I and all in school. So therefore, money-wise, it was a scarce commodity in my family.
And a sacrifice for the parents to allow you to enter.
My mother was most agreeable, and my father, both of them, and my sisters and brothers. Many of them now have passed on to their reward, and I am grateful to my parents and to my family for all that they have done for me next to my community.
Thank you very much, Sister Josephina, for sharing this wonderful story of the Educational Apostolate of the Sisters of St. Joseph and your part in carrying out our mission of witness to the gospel.
No place like it.